Hey, and welcome back to the Active Measures Newsletter Podcast. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University.
And I'm Mark Jacobson, non-resident fellow at the Pell Center.
You know, Mark, we've been at this now for a month, and what I got to tell you is that I look forward to this every week, just a chance to talk with you about some of these stories that were seen in the news. It's like we're back in D.C. all over again together. Well, you're still there, but it was like I'm back.
I'm still here, right. Yeah. And look, there's a relentless pace of things happening out there in the disinformation space, both in the U.S. and, of course, abroad as well.
Well, and there's plenty for us to talk about this week, too. So why don't you get us out started?
Sure. I'll start tonight with a co-authored report released from the Carter Center and the McCain Institute entitled The Disinformation Economy. Now, this report is from a team of scholars at the Carter Center and the McCain Institute, led by Michael Scholtens of the Carter Center and Pedro Pisano of the McCain Institute. And they are, as the title suggests, exploring the dark world of the disinformation economy, where fabricated stories and misleading content have been published solely to generate advertising revenue through the social media clicks and shares. Now, as many of our readers and listeners, I guess now, will recall, this phenomenon really first gained major attention in the lead up to the 2016 U.S. elections, when teenagers in Macedonia, not for ideological reasons, but again, for money, for purposes of making money, created pop-up websites that pumped out completely fake political stories. I mean, again, they're not ideologues here. They don't care about the election. They're just savvy operators who realized they could exploit the virality of misinformation to rake in a lot of money. Now, while those Macedonian teens were small players, their ploy revealed a very lucrative blueprint that bigger disinformation operators would soon follow and amplify. And that's the focus of this report. So during the 2020 election cycle, sites known for repeatedly publishing false and misleading information saw a 156% spike in Facebook engagement between Election Day and inauguration as they drown out mainstream sources. In fact, the top 20 performing links spreading voter fraud disinformation had a potential audience of 31 million Facebook users. So what was the driving force? Well, an estimated $235 million that flowed to these disinformation publishers in 2019 through programmatic advertising on their sites. In 2022 alone, the top 40 U.S.-based disinformation sites took in $42.7 million in ad revenue. So how does disinformation continue being so lucrative? Well, it has everything to do with online advertising's ad tech ecosystem. So let me explain that briefly. An ad tech ecosystem or an ad tech system acts as a broker between companies who buy ads and website publishers selling ad space. There are thousands of interconnected players, and the supply chain is unbelievably complex. And this can often result in ads being resold multiple times before its final placement. So you have an opaque marketplace. It's ripe for cover organizations and slipping things in there. And so big advertisers like Amazon, HP, and Verizon might inadvertently fund disinfo sites without even realizing it. You know, even credible outlets like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, share ad tech vendors with known disinformation peddlers. Google, the ad tech behemoth, may directly facilitate over a quarter of all ad revenue flowing to U.S. disinformation sites, though there's frankly not enough transparency to know for sure. So just to kind of sum up the report here, while dismantling the disinformation economy, they argue, won't be easy, the authors note that the solution really begins with a wider adoption of strategies to cut off these ad revenue streams that incentivize the spread of disinformation for profit. This might involve social media platforms restricting viral engagement to advertisers who use block lists and ad tech exclusions that get rid of certain players. There has to be a multifaceted approach. But, you know, frankly, Jim, make no mistake, as long as there's money to be made in manufacturing disinformation, there are going to be a lot of people out there all too happy to keep doing it. And frankly, tackling this issue has to be a priority for those who want to get rid of this cancer of disinformation out in the digital media landscape.
You know, Mark, the thing that I can't get my head fully around is why do these disinformation sites make money on online advertising when the newspapers that we grew up reading don't? Like what
Well,
broke?
this information's more fun. Come on, it's a twist on. It's not dog bites man. That's the story, but man bites dog. You know, when it's a alien baby dog with you know, that spews fire bites man. You know, hey, that gets the story. You know, we all know that. You know, whether it's Mark Twain's example that you know, Gutenberg's printing press gave. You know, gave news stories, gave truth a pair of wings, but gave falsehoods two pair. Yeah. To the, I think it was the Yale study on disinformation spreading six times faster than the truth. I mean, that's what people are. It's the clickbait.
Well, it says something about us probably as a species in terms of our appetite for. I also think
I'm not going to go that far, Jim. I'm going to say it says something about us as Americans who have this incredible appetite for disinformation. I'm not sure it's the same problem. All there are parts of the world where rumor and conspiracy flow just as quickly as in the U.S., but yeah. I think it's a particularly American problem.
But, you know, I there's something, too, I think, about the appeal of, I call it esoteric knowledge. The idea that there are things that you have to be read in, you have to have privy, you have to be privy to the access to have real knowledge about what's really going on, and that's the seed of conspiracy theory that I don't know that we'll ever be able to totally rid ourselves from. But once upon a time, we used to think that things like critical thinking and reason and logic. Would count for something, and that they seem less salient, less relevant, less actively applied today. But that might just be me on my soapbox.
No, that's okay. And I have an article we'll probably discuss next week that came out from the University of Illinois Chicago about how lousy people are at identifying what is or isn't a conspiracy theory when it's something they want to believe.
They want to believe in it. Yeah. Well, look, one of the things that I believe in is the importance of bipartisanship. Watch this segue. So this week we had a number of articles, and typically we don't hit the same story from multiple reporting outlets unless they have something new to say. But we thought that the stories about the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence hearing on threats to America's elections covered enough. There was enough variation across that reporting that we've got stuff from the actual prepared statements by the three primary witnesses, Alvaro Haynes, the Director of National Intelligence, Jen Easterly, the Director of CISA, a part of Homeland Security, and Larissa Knapp, who works at the FBI. But we also have reporting from NPR. We have reporting from USA Today, from Reuters, from The Record. There's a tremendous amount of good reporting. But what I did, I went back and I did my own reporting, if you will, and I actually took the time to listen and watch the entirety of the hearing chaired by Senator Warner from Virginia, his deputy, ranking member on the Republican side is Marco Rubio. And a couple things that leapt out at me about this hearing, and we could talk about some of it at length. Number one, this is the way the Senate's supposed to work. There was real bipartisanship. Yep, there was different perspective on the issues, but there was a bipartisan recognition that disinformation is real, that there are bad actors who want to target the United States. And even coming out of 2016, in the middle of the Trump administration, it was the Senate Intelligence Committee, then chaired by Senator Burr, a Republican from North Carolina, that did the best work identifying on a bipartisan basis what the Russians had done in 2016. And I think we still see the fruits of that labor when you can have Warner and Rubio, sure, but you can have others from both the left and the right, Bennett from Colorado, Risch from the right, talking about these issues with their own perspectives, their own viewpoints, maybe their own sense of what we can do about it. But there was still bipartisan comedy, as we used to call it. Look, I want to hit a couple of key points. Senator Warner, in his opening remarks, talked about that our adversaries have both the incentive, you could call it the will, you could call it the motive, to use disinformation as a weapon against America. He also emphasized that they have the means, right? As I was listening to this, the old national security analyst in me, he was talking about incentive and means. I heard capabilities and intentions, right? And that is the one of the sort of foundational concepts in thinking about threats to national security. Our adversaries have the desire to do us some harm, and they have the ability to do us some harm. That's something that we need to be paying attention to. Marco Rubio, though, brought a different perspective to this, and it was, I thought, really instrumental and something maybe you and I ought to talk a little bit about. But he, the senator from Florida, pointed out the respect and the integrity of the National Hurricane Center. So when a forecast comes up and the National Hurricane Center says, "Hey, there's a Category 4 or 5 storm, and you better get out of the way," people tend to listen. Certainly not exclusively, but enough people listen, enough people get out of the way, they save lives. He said, "What's going to happen if a obvious piece of disinformation comes down the pike 48 hours before the election? Who is going to stand up and be the voice and says, 'Hey, America, this is fraudulent. It's not real. We might not know yet who it's coming from, but we know that this did not take place, and here are the reasons why.'" Is it going to be the U.S. government? Is it going to be the Director of National Intelligence? She said that was her job. But who will be the person? Who will be the trusted voice to say, essentially play referee at the risk of being deemed a political puppet by one side or the other? Because, that kind of information may be useful to one side or the other on the eve of an election. So there's more we can talk about from this, but let's grapple with that. Who should be saying, "Hey, this is disinformation, America"?
Well, Jim, I worry that disinformation has been so incredibly corrosive that it is it's part of the reason we have reduced public trust in government. I think today, I think the figures are around 25% of if you take Democrats and Republicans say they trust the federal government just about always or most of the time. I worry about those. I'm not exactly sure on those numbers. I should know them actually, but trust is down, and frankly, it's not just disinformation, but I'm gonna really screw up George Washington's quote about political parties and even though they answer popular ends, that they could become but it can become a vehicle where ambitious and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people. And I think that's a problem when you take when politics, electoral politics, and partisan politics become just partisan all the time, and become corrosive. And it's going to make it very difficult the next time there is something. Just think about the next pandemic. Are people really going to have faith in the CDC? Are people going to have faith in the White House? No matter which political party's up there, I
Yeah.
think
Well,
we're going
but
to have a problem.
so if we're lucky, it'll be another century before we have another pandemic. And I'm knocking wood as I say that, right? We know that there's going to be disinformation in the 2020 cycle, right? And so you think about what some folks did to denigrate the voices of in government who were doing their jobs. Is Alvaro Haines ready for the Anthony Fauci treatment? That's the fundamental question, right?
And I still think this is a great failure of the Obama administration at the end of their term in not making public, loud public pronouncements, not on Friday afternoons, about this disinformation threat. And again, as it was, would everyone have believed that it was a nonpartisan statement? Probably not, but it was something important that should have gone out there. And I just, again, I think history will be the final judge. I just don't think they did enough.
And it's the difference really between governing and politics. And sometimes the
Yes.
governing is tough. Hey, I want to from this here, and I want to highlight three other key things. So the Director of National Intelligence identified three broad trends. She said that there are more foreign actors engaged in the space than before. So the big three, Russia, China, Iran, they're all there. They have different motives, different reasons for doing it, and different tool sets that they like, that they seem to prefer. But there are also other states that are playing in American politics, and there are also some non-state actors also active in American politics. That's interesting, in space worth watching. Her second broad trend is that increasingly And this goes ties back into the piece from the Carter Center and the McCain Institute. Increasingly, there are disinformation outlets for hire. They counted in the 2020 cycle, 48 countries where different for-profit corporations were running disinformation campaigns to affect electoral outcomes, right? In some places, this is just seen as part of politics. Lord help us if we're willing to accept that in America. The last piece is that there was a pretty much bipartisan consensus concern about the threat of artificial intelligence to produce disinformation at scale with a pace and a rapidity the likes of which we haven't seen. What I really, what was playing in my mind as I listened to this whole thing is that I didn't hear any of the tempering that we tried, that we heard from our friend Olga Belogolova a couple weeks ago and her colleagues in foreign affairs, where they, you know, said, look, you know, it's real, but don't overhype it. I don't think that these folks, either the senators on the committee or the three witnesses were overhyping anything, but they were clearly saying this threat is real. It's here. We're going to deal with this as part of the 2024 cycle.
Well, the good and the bad news is that there's such a great threat posed by Chinese disinformation that is one of the few areas that Congress seems to be working on a bipartisan front on. From an advocacy standpoint, that's how I'd be approaching bolstering U.S. capabilities, is use China as the stalking horse. Now, I'd like to talk about a couple of reviews of a new book out there. So my particular pieces we're going to talk about that were featured in Active Measures newsletter are entitled Fighting with Lies by Darren O'Byrne in The Critic, and Information Warfare and Its Casualties by Gavin Wild in the Lawfare website/blog. Now, both authors are writing about a new book out there by Peter Pomerantsev entitled How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. Now, I've given you a lot there just in a sentence or two. So what are we really talking about? Well, Peter Pomerantsev has written a book that's largely a biography of one of the giants of the propaganda world, Sefton Delmar. Now, while Delmar is not a household name, although in my household it is, I can't tell you what an incredibly important figure he was. He was a journalist turned black propagandist during the Second World War. I have a copy of his book, Black Boomerang. It's a prized possession and very relevant for the disinformation space today. Now, before I begin to tell you about what the book reviews were like, let me tell you a little bit about Sefton Delmar and why he's important. He was part of Britain's political warfare executive during the Second World War. He was born in Berlin to Australian parents and experienced the intense German nationalism and propaganda surrounding World War I when he was a child. And it gave him a really solid understanding of the German psyche, especially, you know, not just the war, but the defeat after the war. Now, later on in his career, he was the Berlin correspondent for the Daily Express newspaper in the lead up to World War II. So Delmar witnessed firsthand the rise of Nazism and Hitler's ability to tap into deep-seated insecurities and a desire for a redemptive national hero. In fact, Delmar conducts an interview with Hitler in 1931. That's how close he's able to get to him. So during World War II, in the employ of the Brits, Delmar masterminded an innovative black propaganda campaign. And by black, we mean that the information is not true and we're disguising the source. So this is information that was designed to undermine the Third Reich by pretending it was coming from within Germany. And he essentially outmaneuvered Hitler's notorious propaganda master, Joseph Goebbels. So in himself, Delmar is really a forgotten master of Britain's information warfare against the Nazis. So Peter's book provides a basis for analyzing Delmar's tactics and really grappling with some of the ethical dilemmas surrounding the use of disinformation as a counter to dangerous lies and narratives. Now, Peter himself is a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He co-directs the ARENA initiative, which is designed to overcome the challenges posed by disinformation and polarization. And he's a well-established author. He wrote a book in 2016 called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible about Russian propaganda, and another book called This is Not Propaganda, That came out in 2019. So he has a sort of a similar background to Delmer, you know, a journalist. He speaks Russian. So in his book, he's talking about Delmer in World War II, but he intersperses it, you know, every other chapter or so with a discussion about the war in Ukraine and Russian disinformation efforts. But let me just kind of talk about kind of three main points, if you don't have time to read the book or read more about Delmer. The first point is that Delmer was a master at crafting disinformation narratives that were tailored to exploit the insecurities of the German population. He tapped into this need for a sense of belonging, the desire for a redemptive national hero like Hitler. And so he flooded Germany with stories glorifying Hitler in the military, but simultaneously through the same media, on radio in particular, but also newspapers and other publications, he simultaneously subverts the regime through tales of corruption, desertion, and pornographic depravity among the Nazi elite. His covert radio broadcast played on Germans' own voyeurism and sowed confusion and distrust. So I think last week we were talking about how, you know, it's really important to get people to listen to your station. So you do that with good music, you do it with good stories. And a lot of stuff out there is true. It's to get people to listen, or it's neutral. Good music, for example. But then you are gaining the trust of the audience, and you're turning on them at the last possible moment. And I don't have time to get into it tonight, but Black Boomerang has a wonderful story. And Peter gets into this as well, about how Delmer set up radio stations that were providing so much truthful information that at the key operational moment in the war, the station would turn and give false information that resulted in one case, tens of thousands of German troops being taken prisoner. So the second point briefly is that, you know, these review articles grapple with the morality and potential consequences of deploying disinformation, even for an ethical cause. You know, should we use our own conspiracy theories and our own disinformation to defend ourselves or to attack the Russians to prevent their own disinformation? You know, is it a tragic necessity? Should it still give us pause? I mean, these are important questions for today. And the third major point I think I take away from this is that there's a human vulnerability, that enables really the success of dangerous propaganda and its defeat through these subversive counter narratives. Identity can often trump facts. There's crowd dynamics and tribalistic behaviors that amplify the perils. And Jim, we've talked about how disinformation takes advantage of these. Now, could we use it? Could we counter disinformation with more disinformation? So again, the study of Delmer's techniques really makes for a gripping examination of disinformation, both in the Second World War era and today. But again, I haven't finished Peter's book yet, but I'm familiar with Delmer's work, and I don't know whether the harsh methods that helped to defeat Nazi Germany's evils could and should be replicated today against authoritarians like Putin. I don't think Peter provides any clear answers so far, but the authors of the reviews argue that this is just an important quandary that needs to be wrestled with.
Well, this is a question that we're on a commission that's grappling with some of these issues, and it's one of the questions, right? Is that do we need more disinformation for everybody? I'm skeptical of that approach. There are certainly some things that might have to be done in a less opaque way, we put it that way. But particularly for official U.S. government sources, thinking in terms of fighting the big lie with the big truth, that resonates with me. Maybe that's Pollyannish, but.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, we've talked about the strategy of truth during the Cold War, and I think that has to overwhelmingly be the campaign you take. The counter narrative, has to be based on the actions too that we represent as a nation. Whether or not there should be covert influence activities, yeah, I actually think there should be as well. But if you rely on those as the focal point for your information operations as a nation, I think you're running down a very dark and potentially disastrous path, especially if you're a democracy.
Hey, well, so speaking of actions, I've got in our last few minutes here, I've got actually two stories that both speak to actions. The first is from Julian Barnes and Stephen Lee Myers in the New York Times. Headline: Russian disinformation videos smear Biden ahead of U.S. election. So again, this is just evidence that this stuff is real. It's happening. But essentially, the story is about a troll farm that is purportedly in Kyiv that is targeting the American election. Now, let's just stipulate up front. This has been repudiated and dismissed as a bogus piece of Russian disinformation. But there is a AI-generated audio purportedly from an operator in this troll farm that says, and the quote here is, "Long story short, we were asked to do everything to prevent Donald Trump from winning the elections." Supposedly, this is a CIA-backed operation. The CIA spokesperson, Walter Trosin, said that the agency was not involved in any way. He said, quote, "This claim is patently false and precisely the type of disinformation that the intelligence community has long warned about. CIA is a foreign-focused organization that takes our obligation to remain uninvolved in American politics and elections very seriously." But that's exactly the point, right? Is that it undermines the credibility of an important American institution. It undermines the perceived integrity of the American election. And it plays into a anti-government narrative on the American right, which believes that the government is taking a hand, the deep state, as it were. We're taking a hand in keeping Donald Trump out of power.
Right. It's a win-win for Moscow. If it's exactly what we would recommend that they do. If they wanted to erode faith in democratic institutions, particularly in the federal government. And why would Moscow want to erode Americans' faith and confidence in the Central Intelligence Agency? I can't really understand that. I
can't quite put my finger on it. Yeah, the other story, again, this one falls into the category of something that you have called the psychology of the deed. This is reporting from Dan DeLuce and Jean-Nicolas Five in for NBC News. The headline is Russia's brazen and intensifying sabotage campaign across Europe. There's a lot of really interesting details in here, but essentially what they are documenting is a sabotage campaign in Europe that is targeting Western support for Ukraine, including railways, military bases, and other sites used to either transit, store, or transport arms and munitions headed for the front in Ukraine. The arson, the sabotage, is seen as originating with Russian direction, and it is a really sort of staggering moment where we're talking about not just the potential loss of life, but certainly loss of property on Western soil. Related to the war in Ukraine and with Russian actors. This is maybe an underreported story, but I found this one particularly troubling given the trajectory of the war at this particular moment.
I just finished watching the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. I guess maybe we'll have to do a review on that sometime. Not directly on point, but a highly fictionalized account of the British political and warfare executive, or basically the Ministry of Dirty Tricks during the Second World War. And there is something to be said about how sabotage and how actions can be timed at just the right point to either help exacerbate a division created by information and disinformation, or afterwards you can use the psychological impact of those sabotage operations. You can exploit them through further disinformation as well.
Well, and it reinforces a central Russian narrative around the war in Ukraine, is that the cost for the people of Western Europe of supporting Ukraine is not worth it. And so these acts reinforce that narrative, reinforce that point of view. This is a dangerous moment. I don't know how else to put it.
I think right now, a little off topic for us, but the war in Ukraine, you've seen in the last couple of weeks, indications that both sides are willing to escalate a little bit. And much better for the world if they escalate through non-kinetic means. But again, we see the Ukrainians are in a tough position when it comes to Russian operations right now, and there are moves afoot to bolster that with potentially doing things like putting consideration of whether trainers from NATO should be on the ground in Ukraine as well. So if I'm the Russians, I am thinking about trying to stop the flow of weapons and personnel well before they get inside Ukraine. And that involves not just acts of sabotage, but also, as you suggested, breaking the will of the NATO allies by saying you're risking a war. Is it really worth it to fight this war and risk your own nations for Ukraine?
I was going to make a joke about you have broken my will, but we're out of time. I thought that was funny.
It was funny.
Wait, but we are out of time. That's no joke. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Selby Virginia University.
And I'm Mark Jacobson, non-resident fellow at the Pell Center.
And this is the Active Measures Newsletter Podcast.